Hello and welcome to the second interview in the series Dialogue with Jean-Marc Berthou. My name is Didier Erne and I'm your host. In the first episode in this series, I mentioned Mr. Berthou's prolific career as a writer and an editor, and his latest book about a Christian view on authority. Today we would like to know more about the man, Jean-Marc Berthou, and his family background, his education. Mr. Berthou, it's good to have you here.
It's my pleasure.
God guides our lives in a most wonderful way, not only during our lifetime, but even before we are born. In his providence, he prepares the environment that will surround us during our formative days. God uses our parents, our families, our education to prepare us for the work he has in mind for us. What is most wonderful is that God uses even the weakness of our human beings for his eternal plan. Mr. Berthou, both of your parents were convinced Christians willing to spend their lives in the service of others as missionaries in Africa. Can you briefly describe your father's and your mother's family background?
Well, it's a pleasure. Let us start with my father. My father was a pastor in the Reformed Church in Neuchâtel. But his parents, his father was working much of his life in an organization which was combating alcoholism, a Christian organization, and later as an officer in the Salvation Army. That was Fritz Berthou, my grandfather. And he had probably entered into this vocation as a result of the difficulties their family had with the fact that his own father had been an alcoholic. Now, from the point of view of his mother, or my grandmother, Fritz Berthou's wife, who was a French from the Cévennes region in the south of France, called Marie Abel, she was a schoolteacher and had been educated in a Calvinistic church and was very attached to the confession of faith of La Rochelle. And she was very clear as to her beliefs. So my father had, he wanted first to become to look after animals, as a veterinary surgeon. And then he thought later that it perhaps better to look after human beings. So he undertook his studies at the University of Neuchâtel, where the faculty of theology was very liberal. And though he had a profound faith, it was somewhat damaged at the time by the liberal opinions of his parents. Now, that was his background. On the other side, my mother came from missionary parents, which a generation earlier had started work in Mozambique, in southern Africa, and later on in South Africa itself. Her parents, well, her father was a dedicated missionary, but he was partly a missionary for the Christian faith and partly also for Western culture, that the African people had to be civilized according to our Western culture. He was to some degree, in certain respects, a liberal. For example, he defended the theory of evolution right from the beginning. Now, his wife, Ida Bourquin-Wild, was a woman of profound spirituality, and she dominated the spiritual background of the family. Her children were, in fact, all one to the Christian faith. So we had a double background of consecrated Christian lives in a somewhat different distinction. My mother's family, my father's father-in-law, had a very clannish attitude towards the family. And if you married one of the daughters, you had to become part of the clan. And this didn't work very well with my father, who thought his family was of an independent nature, and he didn't want to submit to the liberal opinions of his father-in-law.
Even though there was a lot of Christian zeal in your family, theological liberalism in the beginning of the 20th century had an impact on the faith of your ancestor. What means did God use to keep their faith?
Well, As far as my father was concerned, when he was pastor in a small parish near Neuchâtel, between Neuchâtel and between Bienne and La Chaux-de-Fonds, in a place called Corgémont. And when his parents retired from professional work, they didn't have a pension because there were no pension schemes in either the Salvation Army or in the organization that was fighting against alcoholism. Now, my father was a very practical man. He thought, well, we must find a solution for this problem. And he had a big manse, and he organized a part of the manse to be lodgings for his parents. And he even organized a kind of work for his father, who would visit his former parishioners, alcoholic parishioners who had become Christian, and sell them tea. So this was a wonderful solution. And at that time, my grandmother, living in the manse, would attend the Sunday services and notice that her son was preaching somewhat liberal doctrines. And so after the Sunday dinner, they would go for a walk with the family, and she was walking ahead with her son, and she would catechize him and, in fact, show him how, in fact, his teaching on certain points was not at all in communion with the teaching of the Bible. And gradually he was won away from his liberal thinking. With regard to my mother, she had to take a very formal decision with regard to her own father, saying that if he continued to want to dominate and to meddle in their own family, he had better not come back again to see them. And this was a very difficult decision for her.
Why did your father want to become a missionary?
Well, he was very interested in preaching the gospel. Gradually, as he moved away from the liberal influences of his university training, he began to see more and more clearly that the gospel had to be preached to sinners. And he did all he could to organize revival meetings in his own church and in the neighboring area, with an astonishing result that in this very limited population, he had 120 people on the weekday Bible study in the church. And he was always inviting people from outside to preach the gospel. And at one time, he invited, in the early 30s, 1930s, he invited a choir that came from South Africa. They were preaching the gospel. It was a somewhat charismatic, slightly charismatic movement called the Oxford Union. And they came to preach the gospel in his village. And, of course, there he met my mother, and they were very quickly engaged, and 6 months later were married. So his zeal for the gospel also led to the development of our family. Now, he was very interested in the question of the preaching the gospel, and he was also very preoccupied about the necessity for mission work. And at that time, there were a number of missionary societies, like the Parish Missionary Society, to which he joined later, or the Swiss Missionary Society. They were very interested in spreading the gospel elsewhere in the world. His wife told him about South Africa. He began to have a calling to go to South Africa. And that's how he became a missionary, first in Lesotho, in Basutoland, and then later as a superintendent of the Presbyterian Mission in the Transvaal in South Africa.
As a child, what was life like in a family of missionaries in South Africa?
Well, it was a normal family life with trusted parents who loved their children and who disciplined them as well. A large house, family house, where we could have all sorts of activities. When we were in Lesotho, we were for many years at the center of the missionary center of the Paris Mission in Morija. And there we lived in a very big house, a really wonderful house, and with the big gardens. And my father had his horse, and we had cows, and it was a wonderful time for children not only to be able to go to school, in local little school, but also to have this agricultural life, and that had a considerable influence on me. I liked that very much. In Johannesburg, of course, it was more limited, but we had a garden. We had to look after the garden as well. And we had family prayers in the morning and the evening. In the morning, my mother would read a brief passage in the scripture, and before sending us off to school, would pray. In the evening, it was a full of prayer, family prayers, and my father would lead them mostly, unless he was away traveling. And then my mother would take his role, and we would go through the Bible. We read the Bible enormously, and this stuck to my memory when I later became, after declining in the faith, or perhaps not having had any faith at all, but God was looking for me. When he came to call me to his service, then I remembered all sorts of Bible verses that we had read in the family. This was tremendously helpful education.
What impressed you most about the work your father did as a missionary and as a pastor?
My father was a very forthright man. He would speak his mind. Sometimes it would be excessively forthright. But he believed that truth had to be spoken. And in his teaching, in his preaching, the truth was also always foremost. And the truth was the exposition of Scripture. And he worked on that. I also very impressed by him as a man of warm-hearted man. We could trust him. I've never had any problems with my family. My mother, we could trust her as well. She was more reserved, less outgoing, more cultured also. She would be interested in literature and the arts, music and so on, more than my father, who concentrated on his missionary work. What I was most impressed with was, in fact, the authenticity of their faith.
Even though you saw the good example of your parents, as you got older, you started to drift away. Why was that?
Well, to stand firm in the faith in a society like our own, but perhaps all at all times, but particularly in a society which has been growingly anti-Christian over the last century or so, we have to have very solid foundations, and they are not simply family foundations or cultural foundations. Though the covenant of grace, of course, is a blessing on the families who praise and trust God. The problem is that one needs to have a root in ourselves of the faith. And this I didn't have, at least not in an explicit way. And gradually, when I went to university at the age of 16, I was very young, I began to be influenced by the exclusion of Christianity from the framework of university thinking. It was not so much a hostility to Christianity, but an indifference to it. And I began to have ambitions to succeed in this field. It was a dangerous path to follow. And my elder brother was also very brilliant, and I had much admiration for him. And he was much more explicitly taking his distance from the Christian faith. And gradually things worked in a way that the remnants of the Christian influence of my family did not disappear, but they became more less important. I had the same preoccupation with what was morally right and things like that. But I certainly didn't have the strength that came from a personal knowledge of God.
You started your literary education at the university in South Africa. What were the most memorable moments during your time there?
I enjoyed enormously the liberty, the freedom to study. But two men particularly had an influence on me. It was our professor in history, Jan Marais, whose name is in fact of Huguenot descent, who was extraordinarily attentive to the proper use of language. And this was a wonderful education. He would scrutinize what we wrote for in essays and the seminars he directed with us, he would examine exactly what we said, and we had to be more and more careful in our defining of our thought and expressing of our logic and so on. And that was a very, very important influence on me. It was extraordinarily useful later on in studying the Bible. Now, the other influence was a Jewish professor who had told us that this Meret, who, despite of his stutter and his modesty, was the most brilliant man in the university. He gave a seminar which was not obligatory, but which was very well attended. And the seminar presented for a whole afternoon, we had discussed three or four poems on the same subject without knowing the date of the poem nor the author. And we had to discover the relationship between the form in the seminary discussion between the form and the meaning, the appearance and the being, the real significance and the literary composition. And we had to discover the relationship between these two elements in each of the poems, treated the same subject, of course. And finally, he would ask of us to give a judgment of value on the poems. This is something which you never do in the French-speaking world. Judgment of value is an entirely personal matter. It has no objective reality. But he asked us to objectively justify why we found this poem or that poem the best and the others not so good. And of course, this was a tremendous education in exercising of judgment, which is so important to the Christian faith.
Did your father see the problems and dangers in the intellectual environment of the university?
Yes, he saw this particularly with my elder brother. And then he saw it that this was having an effect on myself. And this led him to a certain anxiety. And I remember on two occasions when he saw that in fact I was gradually moving into this direction where the Christian faith was of no importance, he told me that he would much prefer that I be a manual worker than a rotten intellectual. And of course, it was very striking that this was not only a moral judgment on certain tendencies that I had, but it was a kind of prophecy, because it's exactly how my future life developed. In fact, most of my life was spent doing manual work.
Did you ever doubt that this new direction of your life was going was the right one?
No, it was a current that I followed. I didn't see any radical opposition with regard to my parents. I respected them. I thought that their faith was very legitimate and was a great thing for them, but I was not interested in that. I had other interests. My interest centered on myself. I was a very sensitive sort of person, and I thought that my sensibility put me on a level superior to most other people. And I became extraordinarily proud and arrogant. And this, of course, led later to my downfall and to my revival. But things were gradually moving in a certain direction, and I was following it. And this direction was certainly against God.
After you finished your studies in South Africa, you went to Paris to study at the Sorbonne. What was the goal of your studies there?
Well, the goal was to become a university professor after having obtained a doctorate. But the means for this doctorate was the study of a very difficult incident or period in the history of the African continent, was the terrible genocide of the Congolese Africans between 1884 and 1910, about, in the Congo, in the Belgian Congo, also in the French Congo. My moral heritage had directed me to study such a subject, which had not been studied or researched on previously. or not much. And I began looking into the way the economy of the Congo Basin, under the direction of the king of the Belgians, King Leopold, how this economy, which was under his direct control, was partitioned off into groups of financial groups who would be the sole economic power in a certain region, the sole political power, the sole judicial power, would have all the powers together and do whatever they liked. And the result of this savage economy, brutal economies, economic system where there were no boundaries to economic action, was in fact the destruction of much of the population. In order to obtain first ivory, and then particularly when there was the rubber, a tremendous demand for the production of rubber, extraction of rubber from the trees in the jungle. And the result, of course, was a tremendous disaster to the whole region. And this produced outrage in my heart. I couldn't understand that people could behave in such an evil and egotistic fashion, that their only purpose was the producing of profit for the shareholders. And this led to an expansion, extraordinary expansion of my research, because I had to master a number of different fields which I had not studied before, like economics or anthropology or organization of society and things like that, culture, the difference between two different, completely different cultures, an independent culture, and of course a culture of commerce and interchange, of economic exchange and so on. And of course this raised up to me moral issues, but there were never personal moral issues. I was very satisfied with my own life. I didn't find anything to say against what I was living in a reasonable way. But I was becoming very angry about a civilization which was producing such an effect. And so I was forced to also reconsider from a new perspective imposed by this tremendous evil that had been perpetrated in the Congo, in which was described by Joseph Conrad in his novel The Heart of Darkness, which gave rise to the film Apocalypse Now later on. Now this tremendous evil produced a research in my, and I in this research I began looking into the difference between a civilization of appearance, which was court civilization, and the civilization of which I called of being, which was the civilization of those who produce goods by effort, like farming community or artisans. And I saw that there were two different types of being, one which was the being of appearance, and the other one was the being of real relation to the reality of things. Of course, we see this, for example, today on the economic level, with the economy of fabricated money out of nothing and the economy of real production of goods. We see this along the whole line of society and of civilization. For example, I came to discover that there were different styles. There was a certain style which was formalized, and the interest was in the appearance of the style. So you could have a man like Ronsard write 50 sonnets on an imaginary relationship with a woman called Hélène. And the interest of the sonnets was that there was varieties of formal the formality of the sonnet was changed. Of course, you had other poets like Agrippa d'Aubigny or perhaps Molière, people like that, who would be much more interested in the reality of what they were describing and would use the form to give it its fullest expression. And this is something which was very important to me. I began to see that there were two ways, one which was a way to elegance, a refusal to confess the necessity the relation, necessary relation to the reality of ordinary life, and the other one, which was a way of life, which was related to the ordinary needs of human beings. So, in fact, God was showing to me that there were two paths, as he says in the Gospel, a large path that goes to damnation, and another path that would lead to eternal life. But now, of course, I didn't understand this in this way at the time.
Thank you, Mr. Bertou, for giving us a brief glimpse of your family background and your academic career. Dear listeners, if this was interesting to you, please join us for the next episode, where we, Lord willing, will hear about his life after his academic career, his conversion, his marriage to his wife Rosemary, and the beginning of his ministry. Thank you for listening.